All right, then, let's do our mindfulness fairly promptly, or our, I shouldn't say our mindfulness, our meditation fairly promptly. Do whatever you like in these 10 minutes. If you're doing mindfulness, one thing to think about is if you have any difficulty, either a physical difficulty or an emotional difficulty, one strategy for dealing with that difficulty is not directly trying to change it, but rather creating space around it and then inviting opening into that spaciousness. So what you're suggesting to your psyche and your immune system, and I guess the rest of your body, is to open up anything that's chronically or difficultly closed. And again, you're not trying to open it up. That would create more tension. It would actually close it up. What you do is you imagine spaciousness. You imagine space around whatever that difficulty is. And then you just allow or invite an opening into that space. And then if it's something that appeals to you, you might also use some sort of visualization, imagining sunlight or flowing water or something like that in the area that is problematic. And this, again, this is a physical problem that you have or an emotional problem. But I think the idea of spaciousness and allowing opening is really helpful. All right, so let's sit for 10 minutes, shall we? And nature will probably provide us with a few distractions here. So when you're doing mindfulness, there's no such thing as a distraction. There's only stuff to pay attention to. So you, instead of trying to block out anything or change anything, you just accept everything and notice it without becoming absorbed in it. Robert asked is, let's say you're having a pain in your knee. What instruction did I give? If you try to somehow go into that pain and wrestle with it, the pain gets more because what you pay attention to, especially pain, it increases. But on the other hand, if you dissociate, if you don't take your mind away from it, you don't have any effect on it. It's clear that the mind has some control over the body, some interaction with the body. They're two halves of the same thing. So what do you do? What's the intermediate course between trying to make it better, physically or emotionally, or forgetting about it? And the intermediate course is noticing it, accepting that it is a fact, but then imagining space around it and inviting whatever the difficulty is, physical or emotional, to open into that space. It turns out that physically, if sometimes there are congestions or contractions that are, if you open them, with drugs or suggestion, can lead to increased healing. So I just imagine that there's whatever it is, you know, emotional
emotional or physical. Just imagine space around it and just invite opening into it. I don't try to make it happen, I just suggest that it happens. So it's a form of self-suggestion. And then some people like to do visualization. I do a little visualization. It doesn't hurt to put a little sunlight in it or a little flowing, healing water, because maybe that cues the immune system to work a little better. Bernie?
Just reading something from the Mayo Clinic about sleep. It says one of the worst things you can do when you're trying to go to sleep is say, oh, I'm never going to go to sleep, I've got to go to sleep. So just imagine all about
The effort is counterproductive. Yeah, you just kind of you accept the fact that you're not sleeping, and you just kind of become more spacious. And whether you go to sleep or not, whether you lose consciousness or not, by that allowing and opening procedure, you get rest. And there are nights when you don't sleep, but you still get plenty of rest. You know? And there are stories of meditators who don't sleep because they're so open. They don't need that time to lose consciousness. Or they sleep and they remain conscious during sleep, either in dreams or more profoundly in deep sleep also. There are all sorts of stories of people that go through these levels of staying conscious even while in physical relaxation or rest or sleep. So, Abraham.
Yeah, I normally get a lot of pain in my knees. So I got this way of releasing the pain. First of all, you sit down and you relax the pain, the knee itself. Relax it. Send out the relaxation energy to it. And then there is a bone when you sit that stick out. Go up a little bit and press on it for like a minute. And after a while, you know, the pain would go away.
Yeah, there are all sorts of physical manipulations that people know how to do. A lot of people in this room probably do all sorts of pressure kinds of things. And so there are all sorts of things you can do. This is just the consciousness part of it. All right, let me introduce our speaker for the morning. We had a very brief conference earlier, so this might, Carl, if this isn't exactly accurate, I want you to correct this. This morning's speaker is Dr. Carl Blasius, whom a lot of you know because he's been a class member for many years. What you might not know about him is that he has a PhD from Caltech in planetary sciences and a long career as roughly a rocket scientist, but more specifically, a person that worked on the science and technology of the instrumentation that allows us to monitor the Earth and other planets from satellites and spacecraft. Is that accurate, Carl? Yeah. And since he has retired from that, he's been incredibly indolent and has done nothing at all. No, he's amazing. I don't know if he's still doing the sculpture, but he went to the art department and started to do this incredible sculpture. And amongst the other things, and he came to all of my psychology classes and set the standard that no one will ever come up to again. But he got interested in psychology. And one of the things he's been interested in for quite a while is biology, and especially the biology of aging. That's what he's going to talk to us about today. Is that accurate? The newest developments in the biology of healthy aging.
Yeah, I guess so. That's an update.
Okay, so what we're going to do is switch venues here, and then we'll set up the room whatever way Carl wants. But this Carl has actually taught a class at Adolden in this, and I prevail upon him about once a year to do what he's going to do this morning, which is pretty special, as you'll see.
So yeah, you got some viewers on. testing, 1, 2, 3? Is it coming across?
Yes.
Okay.
So you want to see, you're going to be over here, and I'll be there, right?
I guess so.
You tell me, you have to go over there?
Yeah, I think so.
Is that good?
Yeah, I feel like turning on the projector.
And so we're going to turn that on?
Yeah, uh-huh.
And what about, Carl, what about, let's open this a little more. What about the lights and stuff?
I think you turn it down some, we're going to have some videos. Now, when you switch this off to go to videos, can you close this one down?
Just not good. So anyway, let's go ahead. I think this is good timing, and let's go ahead and begin the webinar. Great to have everybody here. I'm so fortunate here to be here today with Christine Howard, who is the lead health coach, and with Julie G, who is a citizen scientist and who has done so much in the work with both of them out there. Eric.
Okay. So that's all set up. Problems of switching windows. Okay, so this is something I enjoy doing. I've been doing it on an annual basis or semi-annual basis for a while. For a while, I taught some classes in biology of aging here in the extension program, and I get a very small audience, and then Spencer, and I dropped that. And Spencer asked me to do updates occasionally, so that's what we've gone to now. So since I've been retired, I've gotten more of a hobby interest in following and studying the biology of aging, following developments in research, preclinical research, laboratory research, as well as clinical advancements that practitioners such as medical doctors have made in treating the characteristic diseases that are associated with aging. That includes all the big killers like cardiovascular disease, insulin resistance, diabetes, and cancer. Those are big ones, and dementia. So trying to understand this assortment of diseases that we tend to get as we get older has become an interest of which I have an interest common with you. You know, we're all getting older, whether we're in our 20s or in our 80s, and there's a lot of interesting motivations for the researchers that tend to make this field of study. And as last year I talked about, one of the major developments was the absolute explosion of the number of private entities, corporations and startup companies that are in this field. And of course, there's a lot more training of people in research in gerontology, biological gerontology, or any number of ways of describing this field over the last few years. But now it's a very large focus in human biology. It's trying to understand aging per se, or the mechanisms underlying aging, and trying to affect the occurrence of these major diseases of aging through understanding and applying therapies of various kinds, things that are known, and discovering new techniques and therapies that may help us. Anyway, so today I wanted to talk about refocus after the COVID pandemic, which was still part of our focus last year, and move on and talk about these ages of common to aging. I mean, these diseases that are common through aging populations. So could we go to the next slide? Okay, today I want to talk about three things, basically. I want to talk about some refinements, briefly talk about some refinements to a structure, a conceptual structure that has guided a lot of research into aging over the last few years, and that's called the hallmarks of aging. And 10 years ago, there was a paper published that identified 9 cellular level. This is processes that are observable at the level of the individual cells in our body that occur with aging and probably have associated therapies that can be directed at them. But now there's been another paper come out by the same authors a decade later, which has updated and added a few new additional hallmarks of aging. I'll mention those, talk about the structure of these hallmarks of aging and how they relate to one another and how it supports research into processes of aging and guides development of therapies. Then I would talk about some illustrative scientific advances recently, 2022 and this year, in the area of, one in the area of stem cell therapy that's laboratory research that has a fairly long horizon to get into the clinical sphere, but it's promising, and I think it's worth mentioning because it's representative, I think, of some really high-quality, forward-thinking stem cell therapies, which you may have heard about, should be coming down the pipe as we understand better how the body repairs itself with stem cells. And then another one is clinical treatments for dementia, Alzheimer's disease. There's an important publication that came out last year, and I think it'll lead to new clinical trials. And I've mentioned this work in the past presentations. This is principally the work of research groups that have been led by Dr. Dale Bredesen, also a Caltech graduate, by the way. So hopeful. Therapies, full scientific evidence of the advancement of therapies and their effectiveness for middle stage and early stage dementias. And then finally, I want to talk about a renewed clinical focus on really going back to the basics, the most basic thing, the most efficacious way of staying healthy as one ages is through physical activity and proper nutrition to support physical activity. In particular, we want to talk about protein nutrition. And there's a controversial area. We've known forever that physical activity is key to staying young mentally and physically and staying in control of one's destiny. And I think this is an important area, and we'll cover it next year too, I'm sure. Okay, next slide. Okay, these are the new hallmarks of aging. There are 12 of them now, and they're organized into three categories: primary, blue; integrative, red; and antagonistic, the green. I just wanted, and the two papers that were published 10 years ago and then just this year, 2023, are listed at the bottom on the left. And what has been added this year is three categories that you're probably familiar with, at least two of them. One is aging microbiome. As we age, our microbiome changes, becomes less complex typically, and this is called dysbiosis. This is something that happens at the cellular level. It's the mixture of populations of bugs, primarily in our intestinal tract, but also on our skin, scalp, all over our body. Another one is disabled microautophagy. Maybe not so familiar, but this is when the cells can go into a state where they stop replicating and they change the proteins that they're expressing to go into a protective state, and they start recycling waste products that they've just been holding onto internally, like misfolded proteins and organelles like mitochondria in the cells that are performing badly but have just been tolerated. There's autophagy is a state you can enter into under stress that causes the cells to clean house, you know, recycle all this junk, throw out things, and make use of resources when times are tough, like starvation, or you're under a lot of mental or emotional stress, and clean up their act on a cell-by-cell basis. And then chronic inflammation, well, a lot of us are familiar with that. Inflammation of the body, for instance, autoimmune diseases that pop up from time to time depending on what we eat, and the state of our digestion, inflammation in the joints, and there are markers in the blood that say, number of markers of inflammation that are common blood tests for that say that you have an inflammatory state in your body, that's an excited immune system is causing chemical messaging between your cells that say, you know, things are wrong here, we need more help from the immune system. And the immune system can get overactive and cause autoimmune diseases, for instance, when there's actually maybe no actual infection, but the immune system is attacking some part of your body now because it's misdirecting its efforts. So the primary hallmarks are thought to be pretty fundamental. An example there is telomere attrition. The ends of the chromosomes, every time the cell divides, they tend to get shorter. So in old age, your telomeres can get very short, and this causes misexpression of some genes. Integrative hallmarks combine some multiple of these other hallmarks, like stem cell exhaustion over there. We'll talk a little bit more about stem cell exhaustion and some therapy, but it might combine telomere attrition and epigenetic alterations and DNA damage, or genomic instability. All these things might contribute to the failure of our stem cells to wake up and repair damage to our body. Now, antagonistic, or most exotic category, this sort of a reaction to some of the other changes that occur with age. And cellular senescence maybe is the easiest one to understand. This is when the cells go into a state of non-replication. They just sit there, put out some strange chemicals, maybe disrupt their neighbors a bit, but they stop reproducing. And this is thought in part to be a reaction to the DNA damage that causes the risk of cancer to go up high as we age. So cellular senescence is actually a protective protection of some of this, some of the other factors that cause serious disease in old age, like cancer. Because when a cell can't replicate, it can't become metastatic cancer. Okay, I talked about the classes of hallmarks. So research is often guided by these hallmarks. A research group will look at a particular hallmark that they think is a high priority, and they'll look at candidate natural substances, drugs, or even consider designing drugs to target these hallmarks. Then they'll use cell cultures in vitro or lab animals to test the effect of the proposed therapy. And eventually, if they're successful with in the lab with cells and lab animals, to make enter human clinical trials. So this methodology is used for academic research as well as commercial research, and it's funded by the government and by private enterprises. Okay, thank you. Okay. So there's many motivations for involvement here. As I mentioned, it's a growing field, lots more people entering it, lots of new enterprises, commercial entities, as well as nonprofit research institutions. And people are motivated by financial rewards. It's a huge marketplace for aging therapies. Everybody is a potential candidate. Investors, governments, and individuals all expect to reap rewards if there's therapies that are effective against these major killers and major sources of disability in old age. There's some people that are highly motivated by the desire to shorten the period of suffering at the end of life. So we talk about lifespan, which is age, you know, chronologically measured with the calendar, but there's also health span, which is the concept of how long are you functional? Are you enjoying life? Are you active in things you want to be active in? So our focus is mostly on making health span as long as possible compared to lifespan, so that the period of suffering, of serious debilitation, dementia, growing dementia, physical inability, severe pain, this is shortened as much as possible at the end of life. Ideally, so we go to bed one night after a wonderful day with our family and don't wake up in the morning. That's it. I had an uncle, about 95, that died that way. He would read with his daughter in the every evening. They were reading a book to each other. He went to bed and he didn't wake up the next day. So he had a somewhat sound body and a sound mind to the end. So that's a great health span, 99.9% of your lifespan. So that's the goal here, I think, for all of us. But it seems that lifespan may get longer too when we know how to manage these processes of old age better. So I talk about recent successes, and one area is stem cell exhaustion and laboratory developments in that area. And then chronic inflammation is a pilot clinical trial results studying mild cognitive impairment, mid-period Alzheimer's disease development. So the first one, stem cell exhaustion, is a therapeutic work that's being published just this year from the University of Pennsylvania. Do we have the next slide? Okay, it involves something called brain organoids. I don't know how many of you thought about this, but these are laboratory culture miniatures of organs. And what you can do is you can take sample tissue, such as skin cells, from any mammal, and you can chemically reprogram them, genetically and chemically reprogram them back to an induced pluripotent stem cell. This is like reprogramming the cell back to a cell from the earliest embryonic state so that it can develop into any type of organ or tissue in the adult body. You can start with induced pluripotent stem cells, and you can program them into neural stem cells that are shown here in red, and they will differentiate themselves in the dish into small organs that are like a brain, early brain, and including cortical neurons. These are neurons now that are in green around the perimeter. And these little organoids are typically 1 to 5 millimeters in diameter. And you can develop many of them consistently from programmed stem cells. And like other small organoids for other tissues in the body, these can be used to screen processes of treatment or to be used as treatments themselves. Preclinical, we're talking about long before experiments with human beings, but this is an example. And what a group at the University of Pennsylvania, we could go to the next slide, just published this
just
year.
Just to clarify, okay. this is a pluripotent stem cell made, you take some of my skin,
yep.
Pluripotent stem cell, and you make a little brain?
You can take the cells from your skin, reprogram them to pluripotent stem cells, then program them to neural stem cells that can produce any part of the brain, for the most part, any part of the brain, and then you put them in the dish, and they will spontaneously produce neurons, the green highlighted cells here. And then they'll start talking to each other. They'll start having spontaneous networks of neurons in them, and you can measure their activity. Okay, so the group at the University of Pennsylvania had the idea, well, maybe these could be used in case of brain damage as implants that could possibly become integrated with the recipient and restore mental function, neurological function. So that's what I want to talk about next briefly. This is early research.
Can I just take more of that and get smarter?
Well, maybe. Maybe you have a little implant under your scalp. But the key is to be integrated, that these neurons and these organoids need to make synaptic contact with the neurons of the recipient. And that's where this is exciting, promising research. So this is at Perelman School of Medicine, University of Pennsylvania. And it just came out this year, 2023. I think I just discovered this within the last 2 weeks. And they cultured these brain organoids, and they've used them an experiment with rats with induced brain damage, and they implanted organoids in the brain, and then they watched what happens over the course of several months. And they've had to use drugs to suppress the immune system so there's no rejection, because these are human derived organoids. Tissue put in spaces that have been surgically created in rat brains in the optic area. Maybe we could go on to the next one. They've integrated them into the adult rat visual system.
Just one question is, why didn't they use rat stem cells?
Good question. I don't know. Maybe these were more easily available. Maybe they had them for other reasons. You know, the organoids are often used to test, are often used now, really recent development, to test or to screen drugs. So if you have a program going on for screening drugs and they're producing a lot of consistent quality organoids, then you could tap into that for your early rat experiments. So yes, yeah, so I said, well, that sounds really weird. You know? See, and I've covered similar experiments in the past on the brain that injected one type or another cell, human cells, into the brains of rodents to see what happens. And well, anyway, there's all kinds of fantastic science fiction stories you could write about that.
Don't want smart rats.
There's a radio program called X Minus One that has a story about super intelligent rats. Okay. So, in a step toward testing their hypothesis that these organoids might be alleviate damage to the brain, such as surgical damage or stroke, then they implanted these organoids in surgically damaged rat visual cortex. And at 3 months, they observed that the transplanted tissue had acquired functional blood vessels from the host. So the tissue was being fed oxygen and nutrients. And then the neurons within the organoid were found to be responsive to light stimulation to the retina of the rats. Okay, so they measured neurons in the transplant and found that they were attached synaptically to brain neurons in the recipient, such that they could see evidence that when they shined light in the right eyes of the rat, they could see stimulation and activity in the implanted tissue. So the neurons had made synaptic contact with the host. And so they're excited about following this up with more work, and they have tissue rejection problems to overcome with these mixed implants, host and recipient. Host and implant tissues, and they're planning to do more work, but this looks encouraging. Early work, and now the brain has stem cells during early development that allow for replacement of damaged tissue like this, but after we're born, it's not pleasant. So this is like restoring human brain, recipient brain tissue to healing capability with stem cells that doesn't exist in most mammals, at least post-birth. So this is a restoration of capability to heal and regrow that you can see in planaria or some microscopic creatures, not mammals. So this is exciting. Okay, the next one is a more immediate, and it's a systematic study of therapies that are actually available now, but have been very controversial. This is a publication of a pilot study of reversing cognitive decline in MCI stage Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease, we now realize, takes decades to develop into the stage of mild cognitive impairment. And there's a lot that happens to the brain before you have these serious loss of memory, for instance. And what they've done is a pilot study with 25 patients of what they call precision medicine, a personalized approach to understanding and treating Alzheimer's disease as a network problem. It's a network insufficiency problem. The principal author describes it. The brain requires a lot of inputs in terms of oxygen, immune system function, nutrients, clearance of toxins from the environment, and the personalization of these approaches to screen for a multitude of possible reasons for the failure, overall failure of the nervous system in the brain, and the reduction in the number of neurons and the failure of the system for creating new memories that underlies this mild cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's disease more generally. And this pilot study was it's a system that's in use by several, a number of trained physicians, but it hasn't had clinical studies because they're generally very expensive to run. But they got the resources to run a pilot study and published a peer-reviewed paper in a good quality journal on the results of this nine-month study. And they observed significantly improvements in a standard cognitive assessment, Montreal cognitive assessment. And the probability is the probability that the results they observed were just due to chance. And these probabilities of less than 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 100 are statistically quite significant compared to what the usual standards are. And they observed a cognitive assessment, a very strong cognitive assessment improvement on average over these 25 patients. Another neurocognitive index, similar statistical significance. And then this Alzheimer's questionnaire change is a questionnaire given to people that are caretakers and observers of what is this person doing day to day, how are they managing. And this was also a good significant result. So this is the publication at the bottom. And do we have the next slide? Okay.
A quick question, which is each person, each of these 25 people got a different...
They got a personalized treatment
right. Based
on a battery of tests given at the beginning.
So are these the standard treatments that are... What kind of treatments were
given? We'll cover that. Some of them may seem fringe. Some of them may seem very standard. And it depends on what you're treating. And there's a whole variety of things they screen for. So it's like the brain as a system requires a whole bunch of different things to function adequately and to continue making memories and recalling memories. And if any one of these things fails, or any combination of them fail at different levels, then you can have a collapse of the system. It basically starts cutting back rather than growing or maintaining its capabilities. So you've got to screen people for a whole bunch of things when they show up with MCI and treat what shows up. And they've had significant success in that. I've talked about Dr. Bredesen's work in the past, but it was all clinical experience, case studies. This is the first time they've had a systematic, approved clinical trial. Okay, there is other significant improvements in blood work of things like inflammation. You can read that. And compared to other clinical trials in the past, there hasn't been any reported broad cognitive improvements of this kind ever observed on this kind of a suite of patients with MCI. So it's really good news, actually. Okay, let's next one. I think we're going to go to the video. So I wanted to give Dr. Bredesen a chance to talk about it himself.
So, should we?
Go over to the video. That'd be one that I got up. I'm going to start about 13 minutes.
Escape, or
escape. Yeah.
reality is there's a tremendous amount that can be done on the public health side, as well as on the practitioner side and on the personal side, to reduce your risk and to help reverse any decline that has occurred. Okay, next. So there are a lot of theories of Alzheimer's, and this is actually what I was interested in for my whole career. We spent many, many years and published over 220 papers looking at what is Alzheimer's? What is the most fundamental nature of this problem? And so we studied what is the signaling involved with cell death. And as you can see here, all sorts of theories. The surprise is that there's a little bit of supportive data for every single one of these theories. That tells you something right there. If it were a simple disease, all the data would be around one theory, and all the other ones would be wrong. But all of these theories have a little bit of supportive data. None of them, not a single one of these current theories, has led to successful treatment. And that's the take-home message here. And if you go to the next. So let's go under the hood and let's look at how this disease actually works. And it tells you what it actually is. So here is amyloid precursor protein. You can see here it sits in your cells. The amino terminus is outside here, is outside the cell. So this is called a type 1 transmembrane protein. And you can see it's just got a little tail inside the cell. A lot of this is in neurons, most of it, and in fact, especially high levels near synapses. No big surprise. So this thing is a master switch. When things are good, then this thing actually is cut at a single site, which produces two different peptides. So you'll see here, there you go. So it's cut here, and now you'll see SAPP alpha and CTF alpha. And by the way, a paper just came out said, oh, here's a new way to treat Alzheimer's, SAPP alpha, let's give people that. Yes, we've been saying that for over 10 years. So the point of this here is you have SAPP alpha, which is supportive and telling other cells, we're going to make new synapses, we're going to keep synapses, we're going to make new memories, we're going to have positive neuroplasticity. And alpha-CTF is actually going inside the cell and saying the same thing. So it's coordinating inside with outside, saying we have enough hormones, we have enough nutrients, we have enough growth factors, we don't have too much inflammation, we've got enough energy, oxygenation, mitochondrial function, blood flow, things are good, we're good to go. No different than what you do in your country. This is like my brain stand here. So on the other hand, when things are bad, very much like what happened to our country in the pandemic, early 2020, we were all told to isolate, social distancing, etc. And if you go to this next here, it'll show you what happens. It gets cleaved. So this same molecule switches into a protective downsizing mode. It is making things that actually kill microbes. The amyloid that we have vilified here, this thing that says A beta, you can see this fragment, we have vilified in Alzheimer's, is really something that is protecting your brain. And yes, it's downsizing as well, but it is a protective downsizing. It is literally coating viruses, coating bacteria, coating fungi, coating spirochetes, and literally killing them. So now you go into a completely different scenario. You are now downsizing. You're now not able to make those memories. So now we want to know all the things that drive you in the good direction and the bad direction. For each person, we can measure that, and we can drive you toward the left side here of the slide, the SAPP alpha, and away from the SAPP beta. And that's what has worked repeatedly to get best outcomes. So if you go to the next one then. So major contributors, and did you get that? So I apologize for the math slide here, but the simple point of this is your probability of getting Alzheimer's is proportional to basically a set of four groups of things. Inflammatory mediators, so if you've got ongoing inflammation, you're increasing your risk. And that can be from pathogens, leaky gut, poor oral microbiome, metabolic syndrome, what have you, chronic sinusitis, you name it. Or if you have toxins, and those can be the air pollution I mentioned earlier, mercury, organics, biotoxins, things like triclothecines and ochratoxin A and gliotoxin. So those toxins also, they're putting a greater drag on this system. This is all about supply versus demand. And on the other hand, if you have too low on the energetics, blood flow, oxygenation, mitochondrial function, and ketones, or trophic support, and that's hormones, nutrients, and growth factors, then Beck, you're at increased risk. So we want to increase your energetics and your trophic support. We want to decrease the inflammatory mediators and the toxins, not just get rid of inflammation, but determine what actually caused it, so that we can now change your neurochemistry toward a productive, toward a positive, so that you are now once again able to make and store synapses. And this predicts beautifully what works, what doesn't work. So if you go to the next one, there. So of course, as you can see immediately, because there are these different factors, some people have mostly one factor, some people have mostly different ones. So there's type 1, which is inflammatory from things like infections, and type 2, which is atrophic. These people look different. They tend to be, the atrophic people tend to be older. They're low on their hormones, they're low on their nutrients, but they don't have a lot of inflammation. So they just can't support that big nervous system. You have almost a quadrillion synapses in your brain. They cannot support that, so they downsize. Third is glycotoxic, and we call it type 1.5 because it's got some inflammation, and that's from the glycation of the proteins, but then it's also got an atrophic piece to it because you're insulin resistant. So your insulin doesn't help the way it's supposed to. Then we have type 3, which is toxic, as I mentioned earlier. Type 4, which is vascular. There are many people that have mostly a vascular problem. Again, we need to make sure the blood flow is there, the oxygenation is there, etc. And then type 5, which is traumatic. And I should mention, there was a famous paper in the mid-1980s from Dr. Gareth Roberts who showed that people who had a lot of head trauma from traffic accidents accumulated a tremendous amount of amyloid in their brains, literally within the next 7 to 10 days. So it is an early response also, again, as you're basically trying to rewire with all the damage in the nervous system. Go to the next one, and then you see here, so we're going to talk for just a couple minutes about the trial here, and I'm really honored to have done this with Dr. Anne Hathaway, Dr. Kat Toots, and Dr. Deborah Gordon. It's the first trial. Instead of predetermining the treatment, which if you think about it really makes no sense, we're actually looking at what's causing the problem and then addressing that. And then, go to the next one here. So we were denied 2011 and 2018 again, so we did a lot of actually background work, and finally in 2019, it was approved. It's a small proof of concept trial. You can read about it now. It's in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. It's been published, and also there's some press releases around it in various newspapers, etc. So 25 patients. Now these patients were in that third and fourth stage. Of course, it would be even easier if they were in the first two stages. But we purposefully took them in the MCI or early dementia stage. And why did we do that? Because that's the same stage that aducanumab took their patients. So we wanted to show, whereas that didn't help, we wanted to show that in fact we can help a lot. And so we compared the personalized precision medicine protocol to just historical outcomes. We know what happens to these patients. There's a tremendous amount written about them. They go downhill, as we know. So we looked at all the different root causes, and then we addressed those specific causes. Let's talk about how we evaluated them and what the outcome was. So we used the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, 0, 3, 6, and 9 months. If you go to the next one here, we also used a more sensitive online test, CNS Vital Signs, which is great because it then gives us a larger dynamic range. We can look at people who are less impaired and more impaired. Then we use the AQ21, which is where their partners will say, okay, they've had this problem or they've had that problem. And then you go to the next one, we use something called the AQ20, which is a change scale, which was actually created by QuestGen. It's just an estimate of, did these people get better or worse? Then we looked at MRIs at the beginning and end. Did their MRIs get worse? People with MCI or Alzheimer's have MRIs that we know how quickly they get worse, and they virtually always get worse. If you go to the next one, and first thing was we looked at their metabolic changes. As you can see here, everything improved, and everything was statistically significant in its improvement except the trend we saw in HOMA-IR. We simply didn't have enough HOMA-IRs at the end stage on several of the patients. But there, even with what we had, there was a trend. So everything improved metabolically. And then if you go to the next one, did that associate with cognitive testing? And the answer was yes, that it did. And if you go through here, so this just shows that as they went along, they improved at 3 months, more improvement at 6 months, and still more improvement at 9 months. We had a few drop off at 9 months because the pandemic hit right there between the 6 and the 9 months. So no surprise, a few people stopped doing the right thing and actually fell off a bit. But overall, as a group, they still did better than the 6 months. So they continued to improve, which is, again, unheard of in Alzheimer's trials. And then you can see here, 84% of these people improved, 4% of them were stable, 12% declined. And the few that declined, in fact, typically you could see why. One person had a lot of mycotoxins in her home and said, I'm not leaving, I'm not remediating my home, I'm just going to stay here. No surprise, she continued to decline. If you go to the next one, so it is important to address the things that are causing this. If you look at their gray matter volume, here the former versus the new, they actually improved. This is from one specific patient who actually was not in this trial. But if you look at the gray matter, you can see the gray matter here is largely in this cortical ribbon that's being traced around here, and the computer will actually go through here painstakingly and figure out. So the gray matter improved in these people, and the hippocampal volume, which you can see here, there's the hippocampal volume there. In these patients in the trial, had a minimal change, actually was slightly smaller in the trial, but less so than normal aging and much less so than other people who had MCI or Alzheimer's. So by all of these criteria, these people did very, very well. If you go to the next one. So if you just go through MoCA tests, neurocognitive index, cognitive subtests, the 18-20 change scale, brain HQ, MRI, hippocampal volume, everything in here was better. If you go to the next one. There we go. So we published a number of papers, and if you look at this third one here, this is the one, that one there, yeah. So this one just came out in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, a peer-reviewed journal, a very good journal for studies of Alzheimer's disease. And now we're on to a larger randomized controlled trial, which is just starting in the next couple of months. And as I mentioned earlier, we'll be able to use things like epigenetics and phospho-tau and things that weren't available even a couple of years ago. You go to the next one.
Okay, I think that's enough for Dr. Bredesen. That give you a feeling for how the trial was designed and how it went. And although it's a small number of people, so it's a difficult thing to do, and they got funding for it and got institutional review board approval after a couple of trials, and it's now been peer reviewed and published. So that's encouraging news for all of us that have had friends that have fallen to serious dementia, sometimes at young ages. Okay. Okay, so I think we talked about these, the different sorts of treatments. Next. And this is the publication, and this is where we showed you the video. This is the link to the video. It'll be on our website, the presentation. I'll give it to Robert, and so we can post it so you all can access this presentation and the links to videos. Okay, next. Okay, so what I wanted to talk about was adjusting lifestyle to address hallmarks of aging, in particular physical activity and nutrition. Mega nutrition, major nutritional elements. The value of regular physical exercise has been touted for centuries to improve aging and health in general. But there's a paper published in 2022, which was a review article summarizing the effects of physical activity in the context of the hallmarks of aging we discussed at the beginning, the actual cellular processes that are observed. And this paper outlined the ways that all the original hallmarks were affected by physical activity, from common daily physical activity to serious workouts. You got to keep moving, basically, as it said. If you don't keep moving, you lose a large aspect of your humanity, mental function and physical function and general health. In addition, there's this more complex state of age and aging called a geriatric condition called sarcopenia, which is a combination of loss of muscle mass and weakened state. So you become physically weaker and you lose muscle mass at the same time. And this can lead to serious deterioration, particularly when it's combined with accidents that lay you up for rehabilitation and immobilize you and cause a compounding of the loss of muscle mass and functionality and mental deterioration too. So to slow the hallmark advancement and build strength, avoid these damaging accidents, regular activity plus adequate dietary protein to support your muscle maintenance or growth is necessary. And this is the issue I wanted to address a little bit further. And we're running low. I guess the question is maybe we should do some Q&A, or we don't have a lot of time. What do you think?
Did you want to talk more about protein?
Yeah.
Okay. This is something that I've been looking into for myself, and we found, based on the way we've been eating, that it's actually difficult to get enough protein in our diet. Now, the question is, how much protein is actually needed, and how consistently can you eat protein big bulk of protein once a day? Should you do it after you exercise, for instance? Or is it total consumption per day the most important factor, level of exercise? Some of these things are very controversial yet. So I've got some a discussion between Rhonda Patrick and a Canadian researcher who's done a lot of original work in muscle maintenance, muscle turnover, muscle building, and dietary protein. So that's one thing I wanted to show. And that's about 20 minutes or so discussion. And then there's a medical doctor online. His name is Brad Stanfield. He's a physician in New Zealand who's very active, posting helpful information on research developments in aging that he uses with his own clients. Day to day, older people for the most part. And he's talking about the utility of using protein powders to get your dietary protein up selectively for older people that really need it to maintain muscle mass. And that's a brief one. And then I've got another talk about early work and diet or hints about how to improve your general health with dietary changes on glucose metabolism. So we could go on just...
Wait, clarification. Is the protein mostly for muscle mass, or is it also cognitive?
Well, what the interesting thing about protein and muscle mass is that just like bones, our muscles are constantly turning over. You know, they're being broken down and they're being built up constantly, just like bone turnover. But they're a little more flexible in old age, and we have more capability of building and building up or maintaining muscle mass. But we have to have adequate dietary protein, and that's controversial. How much and when? When relative to exercise and how much? And it will obviously vary from person to person, level of activity and starting muscle mass and what your goals are. But that's something I wanted to introduce you to today, was this issue of, yeah, we probably all need more protein, and the common dietary changes we see in old age where people just start eating less and less, and they don't increase the protein proportionately to keep it up to a more youthful level, like a middle-aged level, that corresponds to loss of muscle mass. and the growing lack of resiliency in the to any kind of injuries or serious illness.
So we have 20 minutes, so you have to decide which way to go. But it's really good to hear you talk about this because you
My wife and I are wrestling with this problem of, well, how do we eat these nominally seemingly very large amounts of protein per meal? And maybe protein powders. I've done some experiments with milk-based protein powders, whey protein. This Dr. Stanfield talks about using pea protein, which is a vegetable source of protein powders that you can buy and use to supplement your diet. These could just be added to water or to a shake or something. So it can be a fairly light drink, but it is packs of protein punch, such as maybe some of you are familiar with using collagen powders to support your skin and internal tissues, connective tissue health, and dissolve that in water or put it into a smoothie. And so a lot of these things don't have much in the way of flavor, but we differ individually on our digestive tolerance for these things. I take pea protein powder or whey protein powder. When I've taken it, I have no problems. But my wife gets upset stomach from pea protein, at least a couple times she's tried it. So this is something to experiment with individually, but I'm still wrestling with the issue of just how much and the timing to maintain our muscle mass or strength or build it systematically.
Question about protein. Is there such a I remember something about complete proteins versus not complete proteins.
Right.
And so certain kind of protein, if you eat it without, it doesn't build muscle if it's not complete, right?
Right. So yeah, collagen is our lightweight. It's not complete protein, but it does support the maintenance of connective tissue in your skin health. But these proteins, the pea protein or the whey protein, which are two common ones, these are complete proteins. You know, total protein food support any tissue in the body.
So you could be vegetarian and still get.
That's what the pea protein is designed for, people that want to go with animal free protein. Whereas the whey is a byproduct, say, of cheese creation, so it's the water like stuff that's squeezed out of curds when you make cheese. Yes. So I said it's controversial. There's people that point out the problems with plant-based proteins, and then other people point out the problems with dairy-based proteins or meat-based proteins. Pardon?
Hemp seed.
No, possibly. I haven't delved into it to that degree, but there's a lot of personal preferences for ethical reasons. And there's personal preferences for dietary tolerance, and there's also preferences based on research of long-term consequences. So we all have diets that need something, high-quality protein, whether it's from eggs, dairy, hemp seed, or other vegetable sources. Yeah? Oh no, it's a bunch of things. Like if you've been exposed to a lot of heavy metals, then you need to go through a heavy metal detoxification program, which may involve injections or transfusions or dietary changes.
What about the inflammatory?
Well, that inflammation can be caused by toxins, whether they're organic toxins or metals, air pollutants. So you have to figure out what it is and apply the appropriate detoxification. It might be a dietary regime of a few months to get accelerate excretion of stored toxins.
What about NSAIDs or cortisone?
NSAIDs? I guess I can't speak to them as toxins.
No.
Oh, can you use them? Yes. There's all kinds of things we take for. we take for general inflammation, such as aspirin and Tylenol and various things like that. So those can be used to interrupt the inflammation process. But you want to get back to the core origin. Why have you got it? You know, are your hormones screwed up? Have you eaten the wrong diet? Is your digestion, is common problem is digestion, the gaps in the cell walls of your digestive tract open up, they're dysfunctional, and you get a bunch of stuff in your, bunch of byproducts from bacteria into your bloodstream, and that causes havoc everywhere in the body. You know, it alerts the immune system that, hey, there's an infection, you know. And it's not, maybe it's not an actual infection, but it's toxic chemicals from the microbiome. Yeah.
Do you want to see the video? Did you want to show the video?
Yeah, so what you have to decide, we have like 15 minutes, so yeah. Do you want questions or more of this or video? Or
what, what's well, we could listen to some of the discussion of this issue of sarcopenia, muscle maintenance, muscle building. Would you like to do that?
Yeah.
I think it's very thoughtful discussion. And the interviewer is Rhonda Patrick, who I've shown before, who has a video blog on YouTube and called Found My Fitness. And she's very knowledgeable about things nutritional and physical therapies of various kinds.
I'll mention one thing while Carl is queuing this up, which is, if you remember ARP, you get all this stuff from ARP. It's actually good. ARP is really good. They're amazing.
AARP.
And one of the things that they've been saying in the newsletters that they send out is you ought to eat at least 30 grams of protein with every meal. That's their
It's
that's
really
their
about the total amount of protein you're going to get in it.
So that's a lot of protein. That's what they say, at least that's the number that they keep giving, is 30 grams of protein per meal. Say again?
You end up with gout, or one of those things. There's poison in
Yeah.
It is gout, yeah.
You can get gout from too much protein?
Yeah.
90 grams, if you're in 3 meals, 90 grams of protein is not a huge amount of protein.
Right, but some people are recommending 110, 120 grams for a sort of average person a day. So that if it's 3 meals, that's 40 each. I mean, it's hard to do that. If you're eating 2 meals, it's even bigger. So it's a challenge without using a concentrated source like a protein powder or eating a bunch of eggs. There may be a big advantage to exercising before a meal that packs the protein punch, because the body is prepared and it wants protein to rebuild, remodel those muscles that have been worked up. But if you're not doing a severe workout, you know, if you're not working hard, I mean, some of us want to do it, some of us don't. Then your question is, what do you do spread out the other day for 2 or 3 meals? And how do you, what's the protein requirement then, and how do you arrange it?
What do you think of the epigenetic? Where the cells are actually responding to the environment more than the genes. And the environment includes like your feelings, your thoughts,
absolutely,
your emotions.
It's really important. Everything you experience and do and feel modifies your.
Improve the aging.
Yeah, and we don't know half of it yet.
Okay.
There's a lot of puzzles to be worked out. Yes, the interaction between our mental activity and our physical activity is extreme. And that's why just moving, walking through the environment, taking a walk in the park, is it so important for mental health and physical health?
Okay.
Bigger benefit than I need to divide my protein 3 times. Biggest reduction in risk, far not
He's always.
How about closed captions?
Okay.
Hi, everyone. I'm very honored to be sitting here today with our podcast guest, Dr. Stuart Phillips. Dr. Phillips is the director of the Physical Activity Center of Excellence at McMaster University in Ontario, Canada. As we are going to learn today, his research and his lab has made pretty big contributions to our understanding of muscle protein synthesis. And I'm pretty excited to dive into all that research. I spent the last week reading review articles and studies.
Cramming,
yes, yeah. So I mean, now I feel like I've just learned a tremendous amount compared to what I
did. Can you all hear us?
So maybe we need to start off talking about muscle mass and why, you know, we hear a lot, oftentimes physicians, almost everyone knows about body mass and body fat percentages and BMIs and what's a healthy BMI and what's not. And but you know, muscle mass is also important. So maybe we can talk about why.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think when you step on a scale, everybody at least should realize that the sum of all of your body, should we say, compartments, is what you see on the scale. And most people can appreciate, obviously, they're worried about their body fat content. But a large part of what's registering on the scale is actually what we call lean mass, or some of it is muscle mass, and then obviously your bone mass as well. So I think most people would probably understand we're about almost 70% by content water, and most of that water is inside our cells, and a lot of it is inside muscle mass. So what we call muscle mass or lean mass is very hydrated tissue. Fat mass is actually not, and its preservation, muscle mass at least as we get older, is critical for health. I think it's one of the things that's lost on a lot of people to say, well, that's great that you're maintaining your body weight, but if we don't maintain our muscle mass, it has some pretty deleterious consequences.
And muscle mass correlates, I mean, specifically with mortality, right? I mean, there's an inverse correlation.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the outward manifestation of muscle mass is obviously, you know, our ability to move around, strength, getting up out of a chair, that sort of thing. And at some stage in your life, you're going to have to be able to do these sort of rudimentary activities of daily living. And once you can't do them, then you know, you need somebody to care for you. So it's not surprising that there are, as you say, correlations between muscle mass and mortality. It's a vitally important organ, if you look at it that way.
I think the frailty index, which is, there's a lot of measures that go into that, you know, and frailty index, is, as you get older, at least over 65, it's a pretty good predictor of mortality.
Yeah.
And muscle mass is an important component of that, am I right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think all of these definitions, you say frailty, I mean, the precursor would be sarcopenia or loss of muscle mass as we age, all have a component of measuring lean mass or muscle mass, and it's predictive of a downward decline as we get older for sure.
I've seen some studies that have also correlated specifically lower body, I think strength of lower body with improved cognition. And I was wondering, just for me, I don't, like, why not upper body? Why lower body? Like, do you think is there a, you know, potential, like, people that are also doing cardio or getting some lower body strength? And do you have any ideas?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can answer the question, but it's interesting to note, you know, some of these correlations come up, and, you know, when it's a correlation, obviously it's association that people want to know, is it causative, right? And so you always kind of hedge your bets and what I say to people, I said, I don't know, but it's not a bad goal to aim for, to have stronger legs and be able to move around. And yeah, if it correlates with, you know, improved cognition and mental function as you age, you know, if that's a connection between the two, it's not a bad goal to aim for. Whether one causes the other, I can't say. But yeah, I'll take it if it's a causative relationship for sure.
What percent of muscle mass do humans lose, like, per year, and when does that start, like, in sarcopenia?
Yeah, this is the, you know, I would say $64,000, although that wouldn't get you much these days, probably more a question, I suppose. Most people will say that somewhere in your 30s or 40s, you're beginning to lose muscle mass. My own personal opinion is somewhere probably closer to about 56 or thereabouts, but that's personal. but something, you know, probably for most people that you can see in their 40s. And usually what we say on a population level, it's about a 1% loss of muscle mass per year and about a 1% to 3% drop in strength or power. So the muscle mass decline is actually slower than we lose strength. And strength, as they say, is the outward manifestation of muscle, but it must speak then to the quality of the muscle you have and your brain's ability to be able to talk to muscle and get you to do things. So as much as we can do to try and slow that, that would be beneficial as we get into our older age, for sure.
Yeah, and I definitely want to get into to all that stuff, how we can counter sarcopenia and loss of muscle mass. Do you, the building up of the muscle reserves, not like right. That's something I've heard you talk about, or, you know, it's something that's a common knowledge to some degree.
Yep.
What does that mean? And like, is it, you know, really important to do that before a certain age? And if you don't do that, can you still start later in life?
Yeah, great question. I think the parallel that most people are most familiar with that we can sort of pick on and say, you know, women in particular are told that we can build bone mass up until probably about 30. Men, it's about the same. That when women head towards the menopausal transition, that they're definitely going to lose bone mass. You want to start at a higher level as possible. I mean, everybody after the menopausal transition loses bone at about the same rate. So you really would like to be on a higher plateau before you get there. I think the concept is entirely similar with muscle. The good news is that probably even past your 30s, into your 40s, 60s, probably even into your 70s, we can still gain a little bit of muscle. We can definitely gain strength by concerted, you know, resistance exercise usually. So you probably have a much bigger window to accumulate the muscle that you have. But it's the same concept. You'd like to go into older age when you're beginning to lose muscle at a higher level, because then you're starting to decline from a higher plateau. So it's a similar concept. I don't know that we know exactly how much and when, but there are even studies in nonagenarians, you know, people in their 90s lifting weights, and they can get stronger. Now, gaining muscle, not so much, but they get function back. So there's some adaptability left in the system in a muscle sense that isn't there in with bones, for example.
Okay, let's pause that there. If any questions, any discussion, or do you want to just listen to more of this? Yes?
Well, one of the things that I was reading a lot about, what you mentioned, sugar causes inflammation.
Sugar can be inflammatory. Yeah, if sugar and alcohol both load the liver similarly and cause fatty liver disease, so overindulging either of them, or super indulgent in starches, which is sugar packed a little differently.
I want to add one thing to that for anybody in your I've been very
pleased
with monk fruit.
Okay. Haven't delved into monk fruit myself. I guess it's a sugar substitute or a sweetener, right?
Yeah. Since we have you and our time is almost up, I would respectfully request that we finish this with your interview.
Listen to more of it? Sure.
And yeah. I mean, it's 2 hours long.
Oh.
Well, yeah, we can't listen to all of it, but I had a clip of the, yeah, these are really good discussions.
Yeah.
And sometimes she breaks up brief pieces as clips, just a few minutes, but I picked out one.
Is this YouTube channel?
Pardon, it's a YouTube channel, oh. Yeah. Found My Fitness, Rhonda Patrick. And I've showed her work before.
Could you repeat that, please?
Found My Fitness.
Thank you.
So are the slides that you used and these clips, are they going to be available on our website?
Yeah, this whole slide set, including the list of the clips, the links to the whole discussion, and the clip size is specified on the, they're not physical clips, they're just suggested where you listen to and based on time.
So this will all be on swt.org/Spencer, swt.org/Spencer, and give it a little time before it goes up, and then you'll be able to find it there if you want to see the slides again or see these clips.
Yeah, I have a special section just for Carl's stuff.
Yes. So if you go to swt.org/Spencer, then you'll see Carl's stuff from the past and this one.
Yeah, I have past presentations. Thank you very much for maintaining that.
You know
my deal. Yeah, I do. I also have a few slides at the end about things I'm reading and sources, including other sources on the web for self-education that I think are really high quality. I have several pages there. So you can join me in trying to keep up with this enormous flow of information now. It's hard to digest. When I started 5 or 6 years ago, it was a trickle. Now there's stories every day, and you have to look at them. Is this significant, or how does this compare to what came before?
It's a bigger base map.
Yeah, it's a huge pile of new results and press releases from companies and new products.
Next week, the basic structure of the universe.
That's it.
Another of my interests. I can't keep up with it.
You'll be here next week, but so you can talk to your partner.
Organoids!
There'll
be a cereal, breakfast cereal. Organoids!